that my daughter is really very good in terms of managing things. So I can trust her completely in terms of managing the assets and things. Now, she's not in the financial space. So there's no way that she's going to be able to manage this. So chances are she might end up going to a local trust company. But here comes the problem. My stingy husband is going to say, I am not going to pay for a fee for that. So would you help us understand if you have a situation like that, how would you overcome and recommend the clients to move forward with an independent trust company? Because you are going to run into a situation where the spouse is just not going to want to have any help, even
Right.
though the help is really, really desperately needed.
I mean, I think it gets into, first of all, with the child. If the child is, looking to become, say, a doctor or an attorney in a different field, or, is in the military and doesn't have time to devote to, managing the assets on a day-to-day basis, or, looking at the accountings of, the statements that come in, dealing with, preparing estimated tax payments on what or not, something along those lines, you probably want, a trust company that does this on a daily basis, that can handle everything. And, fees are very reasonable. The average trust company, you're looking at probably about 1% of assets under management as their fee. And, again, tax preparation, financial planning, is all included in that 1%. Some companies may charge like additional fees for that, but mostly have that rolled up into that 1% of assets under management. But you really need the time and expertise to deal with that if you're not in the financial services industry or dealing with it on a daily basis. That's my opinion.
And when you say 1%, and that's jumping to the fee that you're talking about, you're talking about is what the trust assets. So typically you would have, for example, properties, title under the trust. You would have perhaps some sort of qualify account that potentially goes into the trust account or any other type of assets. How do you actually determine the fee based on what type of assets, or are there any differences between the
Sure.
real estate assets versus business entity assets versus the liquid assets like the portfolios?
So sure. So, dealing with illiquid assets like, real estate, or like ILTs, like life insurance trusts, usually there's a flat fee, depending on the firm you go to. It's not included in the asset under management fee. The asset under management fee deals mostly with, your marketable securities, your cash, your mutual funds, exchange traded funds, individual stocks, individual bonds. If there is a family business, for example, that needs to be evaluated, that's a separate fee that's, charged maybe once a year every time they look to update the value of the business interest, and specifically if they're looking to, at some point sell the family interest in the business. But it's mostly and the accounts that we deal with here are, just your marketable securities. But real estate at our firm, is included in the asset under management fee. There's no additional fee for that, but each firm is different.
Okay, so that's good to know. So we at least for advisors or potential clients are looking into a trust company, really the best way to start is the size of the portfolio. Pretty much that will determine the fee. And in your company situation, that additional services such as real estate or potentially business interests, that's perhaps it's a flat fee in that situation, or in some cases, if the assets is large, liquid assets is large enough, they probably get folded into the overall fee structure.
Exactly. And
Okay.
again, estate planning attorneys, the CPAs, having worked with a lot of trust companies, can, direct you to which one's best based on, what assets the client has.
And in terms of trust could potentially last for a number of years, some last for a very, very long time. Are there any specific things the beneficiaries of the trust needs to be aware of when the trust company is managing the trust? you know, obviously at some point the trust will deplete at some point. In some cases, they might continue to grow. So right. What is your thoughts on that?
So I think the beneficiaries need to be, you know, aware of the language in the trust. There's a lot of trusts that have age attainment language, which means when, say, the beneficiary reaches the age of, say, for example, 40, you know, they receive 5% of the market value of the trust. And then to say at 45, they'll receive, you know, another 5 or 10%. So they have to be aware of, you know, the trust language. You know, if there's any age attainment language in there, also they have to be aware of, you know, does the trust terminate, say, you know, 10 years or 20 years after the death of the last, their parents to pass away.
I remember years ago, I asked my younger brother to be the executor in case if my husband couldn't perform the duties, and one of which has the language in there indicating that my daughter has to be at a certain age to get a certain percentage of the assets.
Right.
And it was so funny the way that he read it. He was like, oh, come on, sis, just give her the money already.
Well,
why do you have to have that much restriction?
Well, it makes sense because, you know, you don't want to, and we've seen this, you don't want to give a 30-year-old, you know, $3 million. Because are they going to be responsible if they get it outright? Or should they, you know, continue? I think there's like there's a quote, I think it was JP Morgan. He said, you want to give your kids enough, well, they'll do something, but not enough where they won't do anything. So
I totally agree. I know that in our trust language, we actually have that she would have to absolutely have, if she only had a bachelor degree, she gets only a very small percentage. But if she earned a master degree, mm-hmm. she immediately jumped the percentage up to a certain percentage. And right. if she needs to start up a company, if she had a master degree, then there's a dollar and dollar match for the trust to distribute that for her if she wants to do trust some sort of startup company. Mm-hmm. And so I think my brother was laughing and saying, oh my God, this is unbelievable. Just get some dollar out of you.
Well, families put a lot of crazy stuff in trust. There was a trust that I used to work on when I was in Boston. It was an Irish family. There were 7 kids. And the father had put language in the trust basically saying that upon all 7 kids receiving their master's degree, they would all receive a, you know, one-time payment of, you know, $1 million. So there was so much pressure on that last child, the youngest, to get their master's degree so they could all benefit from that.
I'm sure that the other sibling is trying to help the last one to get,
I know,
to get the degree as soon as possible.
Exactly. So...
Well, I guess that there is some motivation there. Now, on the flip side of the beneficiary side, mm-hmm. oftentimes that we've seen in the past, whether or not it's dealing with clients or dealing with watching the movies that we're seeing, trust baby usually is not necessarily a good terminology to have. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, for those children or young adult, if you will, that is completely reliant on the trust. Give us some examples and how does family typically deal with that?
So it gets back to, you know, you having children being responsible and other children's not being responsible. So, you know, a lot of people will follow their own career path and again, you know, become like a doctor, join the military, you know, become an attorney, for example. Others, you know, depending on how generous the trust language is, will just live off, you know, the income that's generated by the trust. And they wait for those age attainment type things where they can, you know, plan to take more money on the trust. And basically, you know, we see a lot of families where the, you know, the children don't really have any direction, just focused on, you know, the trust to take care of them and whatnot. So it's kind of sad in some senses, let's put it that way.
There's always families out there have situations that we can all learn from not to do, yeah. right? So then we can avoid those kind of fiascos and yeah. disasters. So hopefully that, and I remember one time I was learning about there are families that pass on their wealth for multiple generations, and those family who are able to pass their wealth in multiple generations oftentimes has a lot of work done throughout their lifetime, not just at the time of the trust transfer, but mm-hmm. throughout their lifetime to have that stewardship or some sort of family value that they passed on to make sure that no one actually abused these wealth coming through. Because I guess the greater wealth that you have greater responsibility.
Exactly.
In so many different ways. Mm-hmm. So let me circle back to you mentioned earlier about oftentimes the clients don't necessarily know about the trust company until they work with the advisors or work with the attorneys or work with their CPAs. And so what type of the standard that we should probably be looking at in terms of who to work with?
Sure. You know, I think the most important distinction between each type of wealth management firm is the, you know, legal responsibility that the firm or the advisor owns to the client. You know, dealing with broker dealers, they're held to a standard called the suitability standard. You know, basically they're required to recommend suitable investments to their clients. You know, as we talked about, you know, brokers can be paid a commission and or some form of compensation on the sale of investment products, which could theoretically influence their behavior. You know, if like one product pays a higher commission than the other product, you know, a broker could be more inclined to recommend the higher commission product to their client. With IRAs and trust companies, they're held to a different standard called the fiduciary standard. RIAs have fiduciary relationships with their clients as required by their Investor Advisors Act of, I think, 1940. Trust companies also have fiduciary relationships with their clients as required by state laws that govern trust companies. You know, the fiduciary standard is built on a duty to loyalty. You know, a fiduciary cannot put their personal interests before the duty of their client. And the fiduciary standard is the highest standard of client care under the law. But I mean, really breaks down on what type of, you know, investment management firm you're looking for and what's best for you. You know, it's important to consider what type of advice you're looking for and the fees you're willing to pay. You know, I mean, there's several questions that you should be asking, you know, a financial advisor, you know, based on what your circumstances are.
So speaking of questions, we have a list of questions to ask.
Yeah. So yeah, you want to find out if what standard they're held to, whether they're held to the fiduciary standard, the suitability standard, you know, how are their fees structured? What's very important is what type of clients they work with. I mean, if you're older, you want to deal with someone who deals with someone more your age or your age group, as opposed to, you know, younger working professionals, because that can also influence, you know, what investments are in the account. They could be more aggressive than you may like. You know, that also focuses on their investment strategy overall, you know, if it's more geared towards growth or if it's more conservative and more of a balanced portfolio. You know, a lot of clients prefer a lot of communication, you know, whether it's like a WebEx, you know, email or, you know, in-person meetings. But I think it's important that you work with a team, as opposed to just, you know, one individual, whether it's a broker dealer or a single person RIA, because if something happens to that person, you know, you don't have a team as you would have with a trust company, where you have a trust officer, portfolio manager, you have a private banker, possibly a lender and a financial planner that can, you know, knows the family history, that's, you know, spoken to your kids, that, you know, continue the work that was done when your parents were living. So, I mean, that, a lot of clients see that or come to us because of that, because we have the longstanding relationships with the family.
And I think that one of the things that you mentioned that is important is team approach, right?
Yes.
So I know that many of the financial advisors out there may be started as a solo practice. But more and more that we're seeing the transition, or at least what's transpired over time, is a lot of the planning firm now is pretty much a team approach firm. They could potentially, sometimes a lot of these bigger firms that actually have family offices that primarily servicing generations of families. And I even know one fee-only firm out in Boston. They only service families that has two or three generations. Mm-hmm. And that's all they do, exclusively for that type of families. So I think that there are lots and lots of different options out there for consumer to find the right team to work with. But I think that one thing to keep in mind is that your parent's advisor may or may not be the best choice for you. Likewise, and so I think that over time, it probably is best for a consumer to somehow look at what is best for the family and what's the best way to approach what type of team. We do have a questions in the chat box. I'm going to read off the questions.
Sure.
And the questions here is, in case of families with assets and properties internationally, we talked about that previously. Mm-hmm. I knew that this is going to come up. Is the trust only attached to the accounts and assets in the U.S.? And if it's not, what would be the benefits of including assets from outside of the U.S.? This is the first question. The second question is, do parents and beneficiaries of the trust, can they temporarily live outside of the country? There might be situations. So the short answer, I'm going to give you a very, very quick short answer before I turn to Eric for the answer for that. And that is that I'm not trying to sell you anything. We do actually have a class coming in June of 2022. It's called International Estate Planning. That actually addressed a lot of what you are asking, but I'm going to let Eric answer your take on that particular question.
So it really depends on how all the assets are titled. And that's very important. So, you know, for trust, the assets have to be titled in name of the trust for it to be the asset of the trust. So with international assets, as long as they are, you know, titled in the name of the trust, you know, we can manage international assets, whether it's securities or real estate. That's not a problem. You know, there's no issues with living outside the U.S. And, you know, having foreign assets, you know, in the name of the trust. So I don't see any issues with that either.
So just keep in mind, in general, we oftentimes see clients not do, and that's the things that you do want to make sure that you do properly, is that they take the effort of working with the attorneys, come up with a fabulous trust, but they didn't fund the trust. And what we mean by funding the trust is that oftentimes you have to transfer assets under their trust name. So for example, it could be a brokerage account, it could be a house, it could be a boat, it could be a business assets, it could be something. And that assets, whether or not the assets domicile within the US is irrelevant. But if in case of the assets outside of the US, it is probably best for you to work with a local counselor locally outside of the US country. Because oftentimes that local country may have special treaties between US and that particular country. So it's probably best to seek counsel locally where you are, wherever that assets is, and then take the advantage of that local trust. For example, the trust that recognized in the US, not necessarily going to be recognized in UK as an example, but trust could be recognized in, let's say, a tax treaty country such as Germany could potentially be recognized, but there are some implication in terms of income taxes and estate taxes within the US. So I think the best way to address that is to work with the local council to figure out what is the best way to address the assets outside of the US and whether or not that asset is suited to name after US trust or some other country's trust.
Right.
I'm not an attorney, but I'm just kind of understanding that that's what I would typically recommend.
Right. I recommend the same too. And I think the most important thing about, you know, having assets in a trust or title in the name of the trust is assets in a trust avoid probate and are kept private. I think that's the number one thing that, you know, our clients are looking for.
Right. And sure, there are lots of fees, with the probate, and I think that most important thing that to avoid probate is staying private, right?
Exactly.
This is private matter. Anything you enter the will in through the probate court, that's public, and we certainly don't want to have that happen, especially for families that have a very, very large wealth and they want to stay private for that matters. So with all the information we've gone through, what would be one advice you will give our audience in terms of trust and trust company?
I think, you know, the best place if you're looking to, you know, form relationships with, you know, a trust company is, again, you know, working with, we call them as centers of influence, like your CPAs, your estate planning attorneys, getting to know them and getting to know who they would recommend for different, you know, client situations, you know, depending on what their asset size is, what type of assets they have, and, you know, what their expertise is. I mean, that's the best place to start. And that would be my recommendation. Just, you build out your, you know, your network and your centers of influence and, you know, who you can go to with, you know, particular situations.
Right. So I'm going to come back to that in just a moment in terms of the center of influence, but we do have another question in the chat box, and that is,
sure,
once the trust is established, can one terminate a trust?
Yes. So if trust can be amended while you're living, and you, if you're still living, you can terminate it. Once you pass, the trust becomes irrevocable, which means it can't be terminated unless there's documentation or language in the trust that says after a certain period of time that, you know, the trust distributes outright.
And while you're living, and you have to make sure that you're competent.
Yes,
exactly. Trust. Otherwise, it could be void as well.
Yeah, there's a competency thing with attorneys.
Right, competency
there.
Yeah. So in terms of the advice that you provided, that working with the attorneys and center of influence or CPAs and things like that, I think that really concludes very well that everyone, families that out there are looking to have some sort of orderly distribution of their assets, they really need to have a team approach, whether or not that team includes an attorneys or CPAs or trust company or an advisors. It really need to have that team approach, and whoever among those professional that is going to be your quarterback, and that's your decision. But I think the key that I learned out of this is that everyone needs to have a team approach, because not one company specializes in something that can address everything. So it's
correct.
Best to have all these team established early on and introduce them to your family so they are familiar with how to best deliver your wishes, if you will.
Correct.
Well, thank you so much, Eric. This has been a really informative session. So we're so glad that you are able to share with us that your expertise at the NextGen Mentoring Forum. I also wanted to thank California Lutheran University School of Management Financial Planning Program for sponsoring today's NextGen Mentoring Forum. Now, California Lutheran University School of Management offers the MBA in financial planning that helps financial advisors pursue a leadership position or grow their financial planning practice to deploy advanced financial planning, effective client communication, and streamline practice management. Please sign up for our info session for more information. We have two sessions coming up, October 27th at 4 p.m. on campus at Elmont, and that is for students who are currently in an undergraduate program and wanted to take advantage of the 4+1 program. On November the 9th at 3 p.m. Pacific time, that's a virtual info session. So hopefully that if you are interested, please sign up. Our next NextGen Mentoring Forum session is on November the 2nd with the expert of Jake Kuzun on the topic of changing your financial behaviors through stories. So thank you, everyone. Be safe and be well. Thank you.
Thank you.